This is Dave Havoc at the Valley Center. We are about to begin broadcast. Admiral Ed Nelson, who is the Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District. Admiral Nelson will be speaking. It's really the first press conference in some days he's attended, and the first since the announcement by President Bush of an increased role involvement in the Exxon Valdez. For those stations down the line, this broadcast is made possible through the facilities of KCHE Radio, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and Alascom. And here is Admiral Nelson.
Press release. I thought it could have asked us some questions, but I guess I would say, and if I can exercise the same right as any other group that likes to do that this way these days, I would like to make a statement. And I guess that is that I wish we could try to focus a little bit on some things that are positive. I spoke last night to a gentleman of the press the second time, at least a half an hour, rather late at night after our meeting. I don't think my message fit in with the headline. I tried to tell him what's been going on here that I think is positive, what's been going on behind the scenes, and we're going to get to that today. But the spill being a total lost cause was the headline. All I got were three or four lines that said I remain enthusiastic. And I don't know if I'd say that. I do remain optimistic. And it's difficult to go back and forth and try to remain enthusiastic. But I don't know why all of the things that I said that were somehow positive, trying to focus on the good things that are being done here, couldn't seem to make it even on the third page. On the fifth page. But anyway, what I really wanted to say is that most of you have been following this from day one, and you've known how the focus has shifted. We've seen a couple of milestones pass, I guess, when the tanker was successfully raised on Wednesday and moved over to Naked Island. Made a lot of people breathe a little easier. But it didn't detract from the effort that's going on to try to contain the oil, to protect the hatcheries, which is still requiring a significant amount of effort. A lot of booming on, which we think is still necessary, particularly at San Juan, because there's still oil north of it that could pose a threat. We are concerned about getting that oil, which could be re-oiling beaches. And we've got to attack the oil that's now out in the Gulf. Now, it's moved into the area or the jurisdiction of the Marine Safety Office Anchorage, another on the command of Captain Roussel. It's one of my captains here in Alaska. He's trying to address that spill and what it might be in the way of an impact on Kodiak and on Homer and certainly Seward. We've moved some resources there. He's trying to see what could possibly happen. We have flights going at least four or five a day now with ultraviolet and infrared plus the side-looking radar, trying to keep on that. And the news has been somewhat encouraging. It hasn't seemed to advance much in the last couple of days, and it's moved a bit offshore. But we're trying, not taking anything for granted, and trying to gear up so that we can try to break that up, taking some efforts here if we can do something about breaking it up and if possible, prevent it from reaching Kodiak. As far as the rest of the area goes here, that is what I really want to talk about, and that is what has been going on behind the scenes. While a lot of attention has been focused on the cleanup and the lack thereof, but depending upon who you just talked to, behind the scenes has been a great deal of effort from probably two or three days after the incident started, when we got our coordinating group together and said, look, this is going to be a long-term process. We've got to address this in a sensible, rational way with full consideration for the economy or the ecology here. And let's not do more damage to the islands than is probably going to be done by the oil. So five teams were assigned, and they were to assess this beach cleanup. The first was to establish some priorities to assess the cleanup procedure. One for logistic support, obviously when working 90 to 100 miles from a base and on the roads, which isn't understood very well by everyone, particularly in the lower 48. They don't think they realize the immensity of the area we're talking about and the fact that there are no roads between. But that's a logistics problem that's been considered. It's also another team looked at disposal and how that will be handled. And then finally, one on a shoreline assessment, or what is clean enough? Now, that's obviously the last phase. I think they approached that in a very rational way, and I'm going to ask Andy Teal, who has been heading up one of these teams, to describe this better for you. In a little while, he has some charts with overlays. He did a sensitivity analysis, if you will, and he gave us a very fine briefing yesterday. The fact that it's taken this long should not be an indication that no work has been done, but that it has been approached in the way it should be approached, that we don't go charging in willy-nilly and start tromping all over the shoreline and do more damage. We've had full representation of federal, state, the industry, and other interests. And I will mention, from the federal side, we had the Forest Service. So these are people who are called trustees. They have a responsibility for those lands. The Forest Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, Environmental Protection Agency, Coast Guard, the Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior. On the state side, we've had the Department of Environmental Conservation, of Emergency Services, of the Natural Resources, and Fish and Game. And we certainly have Exxon Corporation, as well as Shugak Alaska Corporation and Fishing and Environmental Interest. And what Andy will explain to you is that they've addressed such things as spawning times of fish, the anadromous fish, when the fish are being let go, when the herring season is spawning. They've even looked at the seal pupping, and they're arranging all this in a schedule, give us, those of us lay people, a calendar, something we can look at and get a quick understanding of when we should move in and when we should stay away. And so we'll approach this cleanup, we think, and be able to move from area to area in a sensible fashion. Now, that's going to be the real challenge, being able to move the forces quickly or have enough to get to the area during that window of opportunity, if you will, the right time to work on it. And we obviously want to do this as much of this as possible before the present ice leaves and comes back again. In the late fall or winter. And the best time is going to be from now through the summer. Unless there's some question, I perhaps let Andy explain to you what the schedule is. And what I hold here in a way of hope is that you'll see some kind of a timetable laid out, some kind of a schedule laid out, and perhaps there can be a reporting progress. You can see, well, here we've done this, we've moved on, we've done that, and maybe that'll get out so that people can see that we haven't just been sitting on our hands watching the oil crawl up on a beach or go out and threaten someplace else. Yes, ma'am.
Before we go to the schedule, I have a few questions on some of the things you've already mentioned. Are you taking questions now?
Well, I don't know if I want to destroy the continuity here.
Oh, I thought you said unless there are questions. So, no, it's up to you, but you did say unless there are questions.
Yeah, we'll let Andy.
Okay, go ahead.
You can see what we're talking about, and we won't want to train the thought on something that may not be on the issue. Is Andy? You want me to hold that, or should we?
I don't know if you can focus in on that.
Admiral Nelson, yielding the floor to someone introduced as Andy Teal, I believe.
Certainly. I was just trying to get some space here, but I'll use the side here, and then I'll move to the microphone to get my material. Okay. My name is Andrew Teal, T-E-A-L, just like the duck. And I work for an Exxon affiliate in Canada, and I'm here to help out in the response, and in fact, I'm working with the Exxon response team as a technical advisor. Okay, just to initiate things, I think there's a few points that I wanted to make very clear, and that is, this is a very cooperative approach that we've been focusing on, involving all the state and federal agencies, Coast Guard, all the players that are here are involved
to the full degree of cooperativeness and pulling together to develop what we feel is a very methodical and strategic approach to assessing, identifying critical sensitivities, and making sure that we are moving in the most appropriate direction as far as the shoreline cleanup aspects. And obviously the objective here is not just to chase oil and try and recover oil. The issue is to make sure we minimize not only the impact of the oil, but also the impact of the activities. Unless you consider those very carefully, in some instances you may in fact impact upon the natural and historical resources, for example, and create more of a problem than if you had just left the oil and stopped, set back, think about it, and then start to approach the issue. So that's what we've been working on the last number of days, is trying to focus on that aspect of things, trying to get a good sense as to what are those sensitivities and where do we go from here. In this light, I guess we could say we've developed a methodical approach to addressing these critical issues. And when I say we, I mean the collective we. I'm here representing Exxon, but as I've indicated already, it is a joint effort. And as one of the real positives that I've seen here is that we are all working together. We all have a common goal, and we are working very effectively. As far as the approach, as the Admiral has already indicated, there are five subcommittees have been created with representatives from all the various agencies. And what we've tried to do, or what I've tried to do anyway, is to group them into three key categories as far as the subcommittees are concerned. The first subcommittee is focusing on the sensitivities and priorities from an environmental perspective. The second committee, which is the one I chair, is cleanup strategies and implementation. And in fact, I've kind of grouped into that committee disposal and logistics input as well to make sure that it's all an integrated system. The third and the last phase of the subcommittees is the cleanup, as far as cleanup criteria and how clean is clean, basically, and how that's going to progress with time. And that committee is also on board. They're having discussions in the last few days. They've gotten together. Mainly made up of people such as NOAA, EPA, DEC. The regulatory authorities are going to be driving that particular committee. I'll get into it a little more in a little while as to exactly what is taking place within each of those three groups. But one of the things I wanted to emphasize here is the implementation considerations that we have to look at here. And I know it's very hard for people to get a good appreciation for what's going on behind the scenes. But there are a lot of things that you have to think about, such as the things I've already indicated, but also things such like re-oiling of shorelines. I mean, there is no point in going in there and trying to clean a shoreline when there is already, or there is additional oil potentially out there ready to impact the beach again. You don't want to go in and clean twice. It doubles the disturbance. Basically, you're in there twice disturbing the area. So that's certainly one key consideration that influences the timing as to when you can and when you can't get to the shoreline cleanup activities. Another one, of course, is the historical resources that are out there. And this is something that we've been putting a lot of energy into in the last two or three days. In fact, Exxon has hired an archaeological consultant to make sure we are addressing these issues very carefully, because it's something that we want to make sure is being addressed appropriately and in a timely fashion. And in fact, we're looking at gearing up a program right now to have archaeologists in the field and identifying, screening the areas prior to work crews going in to make sure there aren't any significant historical archaeological areas, just to make sure that aspect of things is being well addressed. The other thing that we've mentioned is also these timing windows from a critical impact standpoint from as far as sensitive species. And we have a handout here that would basically identify that for you as to some of the key priority areas from a sensitivity standpoint for some of the environmental sensitivities. And for example, pink salmon, sea lions, waterfowl, herring spawning, all of these things have to be considered as to when is the most appropriate window to go in there and actually start the cleanup activities. And so with this input, which is resulting from the first committee, which is the subcommittee on sensitivities and priority, That information has now come to a package to our committee to look at these as far as the strategy and the implementation. And we now have some very good information as to making sure that we know where the sensitivities are, we know what the critical issues are as far as timing, and we've got the historical side of the picture well addressed at this point. And the only outstanding issue right now really is this re-oiling potential. And as you're probably aware, there are still areas out there where oil is in and around the islands. And one of the areas where we feel the potential for re-oiling is being lessened now is to the north side and the Naked Island group is what we call it, with Story Peak, Naked Island, and Bass Island. And I'll get into that in a minute as far as the schedule. But given that resource information is now available to us, we can, and we have been gearing up as far as the implementation plan and what all is involved with that. And perhaps I can just give you a very brief overview of that, and if there's any questions regarding that after, I can go through it with you. One other point is I do have a large map that I brought along with me that was put together by the Sensitivities and Priority Committee, which actually shows in living color, basically, where these sensitivities are in the area where oil has impacted the shorelines and also is present. So we can go through that map afterwards if you wish, just to get a better feel for that. As far as the schedule is concerned then, after analyzing all those sensitivities and significant issues that have to be involved, we have pulled together what we call a phased approach to the shoreline cleanup aspect. And what we're trying to do is make sure we're not spinning our wheels, for one, make sure we're giving adequate time for historical evaluation, and providing adequate support to the work crews, because obviously one of the other sensitivities that we place a lot of emphasis on is the safety of the people out there in the field. And logistically, as I'm sure you're all aware, it's a major task here from a logistics support standpoint when you're 4 or 5 or 6 hours away from Valdez by vessel to get people out there and have productive activity taking place and then bring them back. It's been a logistic problem in that aspect. So what's happening is BECO, who are our contractors, have in fact a vessel that is going to be positioned tomorrow in and around the Naked Island area, and it will house 90 work crews. And in addition to that, there will be, of course, supplemental work crews coming in from Valdez to support that effort. So tomorrow we're looking at initiating what I'm calling the phase one, the first week of activity. To help in that regard, one of the things we also wanted to look at is the techniques evaluation. Which are the low-impact techniques that we can utilize on these shorelines, the beaches, to make sure that we are recovering the oil, but also minimizing the actual impact on these shorelines. Approximately 2 days ago, we went out with representatives from all the agencies again to look at a quiet cove where significant oiling had taken place. And we tried various techniques utilizing flushing techniques, manual, a good sense as to how we can approach this problem. All that input has gone into what we now call the Phase 1 plan. This Phase 1 plan will look at the Naked Island group first because of sensitivities and timing windows that have been identified. And again, I can go through with that with you afterwards if you wish. But from there, we will develop into probably a week from now Phase 2, where additional vessels are going to be coming in, flotels as we call them, that can house people up to about 90 people per vessel. And we have 3 or 4 additional vessels on the way, and in fact we'll be here in 4 or 5 days. So once that support is in place, ready to go, we'll be initiating Phase 2 and gearing up basically with the additional manpower. As far as the phasing, again we have to look at that re-oiling potential. And there's really no point in going in there and putting hordes of people on those shorelines when, in fact, the potential for re-oiling is still there. We are going to work it as soon as we can. As soon as that re-oiling potential is out of the way, crews will be going into those areas and focusing on the sensitivities. So given that, Phase 1 is the Naked Island group. Phase 2 will be focusing on sensitivities to do with pupping areas. for sea lions, for example, Applegate Rocks, Seal Rock, Smith Island, all through that chain of islands there will be the second priority to make sure that we're getting in there, removing as much oil as we can to reduce the impact on the environmental sensitivities there. So that's basically it. That's how we're progressing through. Those are the issues. Those are the timing restraints that we do have that impact upon the strategy and the implementation of the strategy. I'd be happy to take any questions at this time.
Admiral, some questions. We're on a very tight schedule, Admiral. Deadline. First of all, what do you know about the threat to Ester Island? There's a new spill moving toward it.
No, what we have noticed that down from Ester Island by Hidden Bay, it is that there is some oil there, and we're right now, in fact, moving a skimmer. The operations group is directed to move a skimmer over there, see if we can protect that so we're, in case it should be back up toward Wells Passage. Ester Island itself is relatively safe, I should say, if we can say that. But it's been looked at every single day, and there's not a concentration there. We're concerned also about the Wells Passage. The people in Whittier are, because yes, fishing and the fishing grounds are very important, but they're also concerned because that's a very very popular tourist area, a lot of recreational, I guess these tourist ships go up there to bring visitors. So they are very interested in that, and they're geared up to assist there.
There are reports that Exxon was warned as early as 1985 about the captain's behavior, drunkenness, falsifying logs, poor navigation. What do you know about that?
I really don't know that. You know, we've been hashing that sort of thing over so much. I'd like to almost say that's history, because we're now concentrating on cleaning this thing up. He's moved out. I really don't know.
Are you still investigating that?
Oh, yeah.
Any of those aspects?
I'm sure that's all part of the investigation, the Transportation Safety Board, as well as the others.
And there's another question of whether the ship was on autopilot. What have you found out about that?
Well, that's, again, that's part of the record. I'm not sure that's... Pardon me? Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
The friend of the Cousteau Society. Is there a particular reason why the tanker has not been boomed off yet?
It is boomed off.
It wasn't boomed off yesterday.
Well, I don't know what time yesterday, but we had boomed. I asked specifically, and the booming isn't very tight. Maybe that's why it doesn't look like it's boomed off. It is very close to the ship.
Okay, so you say it's boomed.
Yes, ma'am.
We were told at a press conference. I was there at 5 o'clock. I didn't see any, and we were told at a press conference this morning it was
it's in rather close to the hull. We could probably use some more, but they have to watch it as it swings. And specifically, they said the other day that they're looking for another, I think it was a 2,000-foot section, and said in order to make that a little wider, give some work area. And they said, look, it's more important we boom it right now and get it completely boomed. So they did that, and I got a report yesterday. Yes, it is, and it's intact, and I had a couple of reports yesterday it was. So
okay,
if not, we will check that out. But my understanding is, but it is a little closer than it would be if we had that extra 2,000.
Also, we're talking to the helicopter pilots, and again, to the naked eye, I don't know. Is it true that there is, are these skimmers working with aerial reconnaissance helicopter to boat? Because we don't see it, and the helicopter pilots say they are not doing it, and I'd like to have an answer to that.
Well, that is the plan. You know, there are glitches now and then, but that is the plan. The most effective way to work this is to have the helicopter checking it every periodical, or a fixed wing. We could put a float plane down there. And
has it been being done?
That is part of the plan. It has been. That it may have not been done on a certain day is probably correct. Because I was told it wasn't covered one time.
I'd like to stay on the positive. I know where you're coming from about that. But basically, shouldn't this chart have been part of a contingency plan to begin with? Why did it take 2 weeks to make this chart, which scientists have known for the past maybe two decades about animal behavior? Shouldn't this have been in the contingency plan?
I guess so, if you knew it was going to have a foreground.
Well,
this time, I guess you could have one all the time if you wanted to...
If you have a contingency plan, isn't it for all contingencies with all specifications? Everybody knows there's no roads around here. The logistics of cleaning up are the same as the logistics for a contingency plan. They have not changed since the pipeline was built.
I think your suggestion, if that's a suggestion, is an excellent one. I don't think that the contingency related to that or related to how do you get the spill contained if you had a spill.
If you're going to have a contingency plan, Admiral, in an environmentally sensitive area, why not have a chart like this?
I think it's a suggestion.
Thank you.
Admiral, how have Coast Guard operations changed, or how will they change in response to President Bush's directive on Friday?
Well, they actually had changed a little bit before then. You probably learned that, and I think we talked up here about
developing with Mr. Iarossi of Exxon and with the state, the steering committee, which we've had established now for a week and a half or so, at least. I'm losing a little track, I think I've said that. But by popular vote, I guess, I was named the chairman of this. It's like being elected to the PTA. But I did take that, and since then we decided we would try to define these responsibilities better. That's been a few days ago. So we made up some block diagrams and defined that I would be taking sort of a strategic direction, if you will, of the operating forces, and that they're still on contract to Exxon. I explained it to some folks the other night that it would probably be inappropriate and also a possibility of liability if I were to be directing any of the contracted folks to do something for which they had not signed the contract. So that I'm in a position of saying, this is where we're going to go, overall direction. Now, that has been in effect. And then when the President's announcement came, he really said that the Secretary of Transportation was going to be a key point, the Commandant would be coming, and he will be coming up here. When? Maybe a week or 10 days. But in the interim, we're trying to do as much as possible to make his job easier when he gets here. They also directed the forces of the Department of Defense, and Lieutenant General McInerney was named the focal point for the Department of Defense. He is the Alaskan Air Command, one of the hats he wears. I am actually in one of our other organizations, his naval component commander, particularly under the Joint Task Force Alaska. So I'm in a unique position of having my boss support me. And he was here yesterday, and he met with the press, and all I've heard reported so far is some photographs of him getting out of the airplane. That is not what he concentrated attention on. He answered several questions before he departed with a battery of cameras and booms in his face, and I thought he did an excellent job of laying out just how he viewed his responsibility. And what he said was that he was here to provide support, to channel whatever it is we decided we need down here and see that we got it, try to facilitate it, if you will. And I thought that his description was quite elaborate. And at any rate, I do have some people here now, an advanced party is a small staff, and they're here principally help over logistics, and they looked at the communication plan. Colonel Bethwick was quite pleased with what has been developed jointly with the Coast Guard, Exxon, and the state. And we've been trying to improve the coverage out in the Sound, because it's a long way, and we have to reach each of these boats as well as have a network. But these kinds of things have been going on right now, and trying to define, well, what would you need? Right now, you know, if somebody comes in, somebody's got to leave. There aren't that many extra beds in town, and you all run into that. So,
2 weeks ago, you said Exxon was doing a great job. Does that still stand?
I don't know that I use those words, but if you interpret them that way, fine. But I said that I think what I said, and I continue to say, is I think they have not been an irresponsible party or spiller, if you will. I said that when the Coast Guard would make a decision on taking over a spill or seeking federalization, it would be if we determined that the spiller was irresponsible, was not living up to obligations. I find it difficult to qualify or that or make that kind of a statement in that they've kind of opened up the checkbook and have responded to all the requests. That part of it I have no quarrel with whatsoever. I think the difficulties we had, and I think they have certainly been pinpointed, and there's a reason why we had a little organizational meeting, is that perhaps that's where we needed some help. Yes, sir.
Decision yet between you and Lieutenant General McInerney on what military hardware or personnel needs to be brought to Valdez immediately?
Not specifically, immediately are those folks I identified, a small staff. There's no point in bringing a lot of material down, have it sit someplace not ready to be used. And we've got plenty of material. We've got a lot of material in. And we have, before this was reorganized or abetted, if you will, we had sent several requests. I signed off on messages to through the Department of Defense for airlift. And we brought in supplies from, you know, from Finland, from Denmark, all over the lower 48 with C-5, 747s. All of this has been purchased or arranged by Exxon, but so the Department of Defense has been assisting before. Right now, in fact, that's what we discussed a bit yesterday in our meeting, and he had several of his key staff with him, and specifically to bring in another load. No. I'm sorry, you missed that?
Just asking what equipment you are going to bring in that you haven't already been bringing in. You said not much more at this time.
We have not identified anything, you know, in the way of a mass movement. We have said that, and I've been told that whatever it is we might need, he'll be ready to provide. So far, I'm saying that we have not lacked for these pieces of equipment. We've been gathering them up all over the country and, you know, virtually part of the world.
As I understand the structure now, Exxon is going to buy the material, and the DOD will also ship it in and help supply it, and Coast Guard will decide to tell Exxon where to deploy it. Is that...
That's not bad.
Admiral, what would happen if a spill of this size happened somewhere else on the country right now, in terms of being able to meet it?
Well, you really know how to pick on the guy, don't you?
Sorry, part of my job.
Well, I hope they have, you know, prepared this committee. I don't think we've drained everybody. A lot of this stuff has been in stockpile somewhere, but unfortunately, I suppose some places may have gotten reduced somewhat. We know the terminal, we had to use those chemicals for a while, and that's part of the reason why Commander McCall shut down the movement of the craft. Now they got them back, so they're protected again. But I'm sure some people feel like they're a little thinner than they'd like to be because the attention's focused, but I don't know specifically of any that are really in jeopardy. You get an answer?
Is Commandant Yost going to be the on-site coordinator or on-site commander?
Well, we call it the on-scene, the federal on-scene coordinator. And I'm sure he'll, that title or whatever one he wants.
What's the plan for dealing with the oil that's out in the Gulf now? Just wait till it gets close to shore and try to protect certain critical areas, or do you have any way of hoping to influence where that oil goes or breaking it up?
Yeah, they told you we're trying to focus attention on that principally through Marine Safety Office Anchorage. One of the things we've got, and we've got the agreement on this morning, was to have a couple of herring boats that apparently not planning to go out of the Togiak drag some nets, herring seiners, because they're the smaller size, to break that up. We also intend to have our at least a couple of our cutters that are coming up. There are four of them going up there, being changing operational control to the Marine Safety Anchorage, unless we diverted one. But we intend to use at least one or two of those to put a spray on. And I was talking to Mr. Ron Goodman, who's been conducting these overflights, and he's been giving excellent evaluations each day on that plume. And his experience is that you do not want to hit weathered oil with a high-velocity spray. I think any time we think about breaking something up, we think of a high-velocity stream. His suggestion is that that is not effective except on maybe a light sheen. He said what is more effective is to get somewhere between that and a nice shower spray, if you will, a low velocity but high volume. And I'm parroting terms here now because I'm only describing what he told me, that you build, if you will, a hill of water, which probably in addition to his extra weight will cause the oil to sink a little better and get into the a little bit lower from the surface and probably work and help degrade it. That's the scheme. So this is why we also consider breaker bars, which would be hauling some plates through the water, but those are not totally successful. We are trying to attack that, and at any rate, that's what we have laid on at the moment.
Does the plan include any use of chemicals or just physical, the nets in the water?
We have a recommended request for that, and we kicked it around last night. Have not reached final agreement on that, and I'm hopeful we'll have a decision tonight. That's probably the one that's now, as they say, in my court.
In terms of the Coast Guard's new position directing the cleanup, have you signed off on Exxon's Phase 1 and Phase 2 plans? What's your opinion of them?
We are working within the terms of an agreement which has not been signed, but we are working within that agreement. It was drawn up by Mr. Iorazzi and I, but we're still working within that terms of agreement, expected to be signed.
So the plan they announced, you have not agreed with yet?
Oh, no, I'm not saying it. We're agreeing, but we haven't signed. Sir?
Could you give me an example or two of how the cleanup effort on the beaches might cause more harm than damage if it's not done right?
Well, I think that I would actually like to have you direct that to Mr. Teal, if you don't mind, because I will be mouthing a lot of words that he can probably explain better. Andy?
You have an answer?
I mean, other than trampling through a salmon bed, for example, which I think everybody will understand. I may not understand exactly where it is because you're not aware of it. If it does get down in the gravel, you could be doing it that way. Beyond that, let me take a shot at it, and you can correct me. If you were tramping over some grounds that have some historical significance, some to the cultures of the native tribes, that is not particularly appreciated. We are interested in not going in there and being ugly American and leaving litter in areas that are used for recreation. And I don't know if those are for openers. Do you want to add to that anything?
Well, as far as the environmental sensitivity.
Andrew Teal, an Exxon Canada affiliate.
All those sensitivities, really, as Admiral's indicated, from a historical perspective, that's certainly one of the significant ones that we have to look at. Environmentally, though, you have to be very cautious as to removal of life that is on the near shore as far as in the intertidal zone, for example. By going in using high pressure or things such as steam, for example, we don't want to do that because what you end up doing is actually removing all the biological life. You've removed the oil, certainly, but removing the biological life is worse than removing the oil. So those are the kinds of considerations, as well as how you physically remove that oil from a shoreline, from a beach, for example, from a gravelly, sandy beach. You don't want to be going in there and driving the oil down further. You have to make sure that you go in with minimal impact to try and flood the beachhead, to try and ease the oil down to your recovery points. So all those kinds of things are considerations that, that if you didn't consider those things, you could be creating more of of harm than if you just went in and clean the oil. Yes,
Mr. Teal, as chairman of the cleanup subcommittee, you've got to have an input as to where they decide to clean up beaches and so forth. You just said that it's important to clean up the oil on the water before you go to the beach. Yet I don't know if maybe 3 days ago there was a big cleanup effort on one of the beaches. Can you explain what the rationale is there?
Okay,
there's heavily press covered too.
What's taking place is not exactly the intensive shoreline cleaning in that area. That was one of the first areas that was actually impacted when the winds came up day three or four and drove the oil into the shoreline there. There was quite a heavy oiling in that area. Small pockets of oil accumulate in and around the rocks and in fact create sheens over time, and you want to try and get that oil out of there as much as you can. So those crews were focusing their energies on removing any free oil they possibly could get their hands on, basically, which is a good first step. Realizing, though, that there is a potential for re-oiling, you don't want to go into an intensive shoreline cleanup effort at that stage.
So you're kind of jumping the gun as to get something off a beach anywhere? Or?
We had crews that were eager, wanting to get out there and do something. We suggested that this would be one effort that we could put these people to work at. However, the issue, of course, as far as sensitivities, has to be evaluated before you go into a full-blown shoreline cleanup program.
Will they keep working on that beach area, or?
That is one of the areas we'll be looking at, again, to try and get as much oil out of there as we can to make sure it doesn't refloat and come off and around and contaminate other areas. That's one of the other focuses at this time during that phase one. There's a shoreline cleanup, but also going in and trying to collect wherever oil has pocketed in quiet harbors or quiet coves and shoreline pockets to try and collect it and recover it, so that it isn't moving around and contaminating other shorelines. So that's certainly another focus during that phase one program.
I have a question. You raised it. How clean is clean enough?
That's a question that is being addressed, and that's why we have a subcommittee that is focusing in on that.
I mean, Mr. Iarosa said they committed themselves to putting Prince William Sound back the way it was before. Now, how clean is clean enough suggests that at a certain point you're going to stop cleaning even when it's not back the way it was before.
Well, for those who are very familiar with shoreline cleanup processes and the natural biodegradation and weathering oxidation of the oil, back to the way it was is defined, I guess, only in terms of time. Over an extended period of time, if left alone, for example, a number of these shorelines would recover naturally under natural processes. And in fact, where there are some sensitivities as far as high-energy shorelines, where the intertidal zone, particularly the lower intertidal zone, where you have a lot of biological communities, in fact, leaving alone may be the best approach. And we're certainly looking at all those issues and making sure that what we do is reduce the impact from a biological sensitivity and also from a historical resource sensitivity. So we don't want to say that we're going to go in and remove all the oil immediately. What we want to say is we want to remove the oil in a logical fashion to make sure that it is cleaned up in the most environmentally sound and logical process to make sure that over time it is going to restore itself through natural processes. And in fact, what we're doing out there really is enhancing those natural processes. What we're trying to do is work with nature. You don't want to be working against it. And working against it would be, for example, removing oil where it's really not necessary. And in fact, removing that oil is worse than leaving the oil in place.
A follow-up. The boom that's at San Juan, we were told, would be a 42-inch boom provided by the Navy or the Coast Guard, and the boom that was received down there was apparently 22 inches. Can either of you explain if it's a different piece of equipment or if the original information was somewhat incorrect?
I'm not familiar with those details.
There are several different sizes of the boom, though. The 42-inch was supposed to form the outer barrier, and I think that is in place now. Not being placed, but the others were not 42-inch. But there's a lot of boom at San Juan.
Okay, we were told, and I was out there yesterday, the outer barrier is 22 inches at this time.
I'll let you know later if you want me to give me a number. I'm going to go out there in a little while.
Would you? Because that's the other thing I was going to ask you. You said it's hard to remain enthusiastic and optimistic depending on who you talk to. I was about to ask you, have you been out there yet?
Today, no. I've been out there many times. But today, and I'm going out as soon as you let me go.
Okay, I'll give you my number. I want to know about that boom.
I will call you.
Thank
I promise.
You.
I always keep promises. I will do that.
So do I.
Sir?
Thank you.
If I might answer that question, it may be the way the boom is being measured. The boom that was sent out there is a U.S. Navy boom that the Navy has, and it is, in fact, at least 42 inches. The part that is floating on top of the water may be what people are measuring. The way they measure boom is from the top to the bottom. I can assure you that the boom on the outer barrier is what they said it is.
So you're saying it's the same boom as, because, okay, well, that may explain it.
I'll still call you, though, if you want.
Thanks. I'll call you, too, if you let me.
Okay. I guess I don't understand. You're saying the phase one, and I'm still trying to justify in my mind or rationalize. You said you're going to try to recover oil off the beaches so it doesn't float off and soil other beaches. And there were scores of people out there working for a couple of days that were Exxon employees cleaning up a beach. You said people were eager to clean the beach. You said they might go there. Isn't it up to Exxon to direct people where to go and what to do? Couldn't you have these people cleaning up oil in the water instead of on the beach?
Well, one of the emphasis is that on that particular northeast side of Naked Island, there was quite a bit of oil was moved in amongst the rocks and little pools and pockets. And the re-oiling potential is the issue along these shorelines. For example, if you have a large volume of oil out in front of that area and you go in and pick up the oil in around the rocks, you can still have re-oiling taking place. So really, it's almost a futile effort. You're not recovering large volumes of oil, and it's just being re-oiled all the time. What we wanted to do there is to try and attack that when the re-oiling potential was not as significant as it was in the past. And so that's really the issue, is recover as much as you can, but we haven't gone into an intensive shoreline cleanup effort there as far as utilizing the techniques that we've developed in the last few days and have tested to take through that phase one and phase two program.
You're actually just digging up or getting oil in the tidal pools right there, because you didn't think oil was going to go back up on there.
That's the focus, yes.
What is the killing time of the soil in a pool like that?
Pardon me?
What is the killing time for what's below it?
How long does it take for the soil to kill?
Well, as far as toxicity,
how long will life last with 8 inches to 10 inches of oil on it?
That really is dependent upon the type of life form, the sensitivity to the oil, the toxicity of the oil. Whether it's water wet below or whether in fact it's oil wet, all of those things are relative to the species and the toxicity of the oil. So I can't give you any specific numbers or any timing on that.
But this is cold water compared to the warm water that most people are used to.
I can assure you I'm used to cold water. In fact, I come from Canada, and I'm used to the Beaufort Sea operations in the Mackenzie River Valley, and we certainly have a lot of experience in those kinds of areas as well.
I'd like to go back to one point I'm confused about. The president yesterday said he'd put the full resources and personnel of the American Armed Forces basically at your disposal. And you're basically saying here today that you don't need any of them. I'm curious, did you have any communications with Washington about your requirements prior to that announcement by the president? I mean, what...
No. Did I know? I'm working, though, through Lieutenant General McInerney, and he is going to provide whatever it is we establish a need for, and that's why he's going to send down part of his staff.
That you established contact with General McInerney after, I mean, that he came into the picture after the president's statement.
Yes.
Prior to that, was there any consultation between Valdez and Washington as to what federal policy ought to be towards this?
Not to me. Yes, ma'am.
Everyone seems to agree, at least the agencies, that getting the oil off the water is the priority. How much oil is being taken off the water every day? Because when we flew over yesterday, you could fly for 5-10 minutes and not see anybody getting anywhere near scooping up oil.
Well, we've got a number on that. We can provide you that statistic on how much. It is a coordinated effort. We do still have those hatcheries to protect. There are some resources down there, so we don't have, you know, just the boom and then go away and take all the skimmers someplace else. There are undoubtedly, you're going to go out there and say, gee, it doesn't look like it's very active. There are some people who are pulling a lot of oil, some where the oil is thinner and it is not as easy to skim. You can sit with a skimmer in very light oil, you're not doing any good. So it's a question of trying to, you know, keep on top of this all the time and focus the attention on it with the resources we have. We have a lot of resources, but they're not unlimited. We have to move them around when we can.
But are there more skimmers coming? Are there more super suckers coming? That seems to work the best with the thin oil.
I think Commander McCall may know what the inventory, what's coming right now.
There's a lot of additional skimming equipment coming. The problem you're having out there in the field is that when you look at from an aircraft or on scene, you may see a lot of idle skimmers sitting there, more than likely because those skimmers were skimmers that were brought on scene early on in the spill when the oil was less viscous. Now the oil is becoming thicker, harder to pump, harder to move. That skimming equipment is not effective any longer. So you need skimming equipment that has got more of a positive displacement type pumps, and that's what's still coming in. Again, they are, you know, fewer and further apart, and then they're being brought to bear now.
And where are those coming in?
There's flights coming in every day. A lot of this equipment is being transported from large distances and are being flown into Elmendorf Air Force Base on C-5A Galaxies and larger aircraft that can't fly into Valdez or Cordova. So therein lies another, you know, portion of the problem in getting that gear from there down to here. And here. We truck it in, or C-130 it from Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage.
And what about these super suckers? The crews out there said that does the best because it takes all kinds of oil, even the thin stuff. Is there any effort to get more of those? And is there only one working right now?
No, I believe there's three. I think there were eight in the state, but there's some question about being allowed to move them down from the North Slope where they've got some primary missions. But equipment along that line is obviously what is needed, and I think they're, you know, logistically looking to find more of the, you know, more sources of that.
They're looking for them, but there are none coming at this point.
I'm not sure exactly what chain we're at now.
Yeah, I think we have some coming. The other part of that puzzle is that once you get it, you've got a rather small capacity really in the skimmers, so we've got to have a barge to offload it. There are a limited number of barges. We've done some other things. You probably saw it when the ship was being moved. It looked like a giant inner tube and one of these bladders. But we've got some of these, they call them bladders, which will take oil. And we're using them. We're bringing some of those to Seward as an interim measure. And then you got to pump it. It's one thing to get it, and then you got to pump it. And this stuff is getting very thick and heavy. It's not just like pouring a glass of water.
Is there any mean figure on how much oil is being recovered each day?
Yes, we've got a stat sheet on it, which is up to date. I won't promise this in my briefcase right now, but I know I have one. So let's see.
Averaging 1,000, 1,500 a day, I think,
right now.
I think the latest count is approximately 16,000 barrels recovered, and I think they're attempting to get about another 15, averaging right now between 1,000 and 1,500 a day. Now, the rate of recovery is dropping off because of the viscosity of the oil, and in some cases, it's been reported, it's almost like trying to pump grease. So, you know, once you get it from the skimming equipment into either a temporary or permanent storage, then there's another problem in getting this stuff out and into and out of the way. So that
1,000 barrels, and yes, hoping absolutely to get 1,000 to 1,500 a day.
I think that's what their goals are. No, as of this morning, I believe they had over 15,000 barrels recovered.
But you don't know what the daily regular totals have been.
No, it's fluctuating from day to day. Again, as some equipment is working and some not, and new equipment comes in. But I think their goal is about 1,000, 1,500 a day, or at least today for the next several days.
Commander McCall, could you address the traffic situation of tankers? I understand there's a new plan to bring tankers in pairs. How is the backlog of tankers out at Knoll's Head doing?
Okay, there's two different programs. The Coast Guard program and then the restrictions that have been put on Alaska Marine Terminal by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. With respect to the Coast Guard standpoint, yeah, we're bringing tankers in only during daylight hours. And with two tug escorts, and at times, you know, there's four tugs in the area where the tankers are, so you could have two tugs, you know, a tug and tankers coming in and almost one right after the other. At other times, there may not be space available. So at times, you'll see, you know, a tanker and two tugs with at least 4,000-yard separation between the next tanker and two tugs. But yeah, we're chipping away at the backlog of tankers, but with daylight-only operations, obviously that slows down the turnaround time. But we're getting more daylight every day, so you know we're on the upswing of the daylight hours. I'm not sure. I think probably seven, but again, I haven't checked that recently.
I'll try to count them when we go out for you.
You have a flight coming up.
Yes.
Mr. Teal, you said that DECO's got a ship that's going to be positioned tomorrow at Naked Island that will house 90 workers. Is that 90 new workers?
In talking with DECO yesterday, we've been meeting with them very frequently in the last few days just to go through this action plan, so to speak. Their indication is that they are ready now to move this vessel into place to house 90 of their people. They have apparently approximately 300 people that are working the issue right now. 90 of those then will be put directly on the scene so that they'll have more time to be there to respond to the incident.
Okay, and then you said that in about 3 or 4 days that 3 or 4 more vessels will be in place. More calls go out to hire more folks. As you know, Valdez is overflowing with people looking for work right now. Can we expect some major calls here pretty soon?
I'm not managing the numbers, so I'm afraid I can't give you any direct information on that. But certainly we are progressing. There are vessels coming in to support the work crews, and as we go through the phased approach, numbers will increase.
Do you know of somebody that I can contact to find out about that?
Yes, actually, but Mr. Harrison, who came up to give Mr. Iorossi a break, said that by the end of next week there'll be 500 more employees on Exxon's payroll. It'll be about 800 people on the contract for this type of work or whatever.
Are these local people?
Yes. All.
Compared to other cleanups, is this the average of 1,000 barrels a day or 15,000 barrels recovered so far? Is that good, better, or average?
I think that's better than we were doing.
Compared to other spills in the past?
I couldn't answer that very well. I don't really know. Commander McCall may be able to tell you that.
Yeah, basically, there's never been a spill of this size and this remoteness with this amount of physical and logistical difficulties. So it's really hard to compare this with anything else. But that's 16,000 barrels of oil. You know, the water has been separated, decanted off of it. So that's oil.
What have you learned of this oil spill? What would you be able to do better next time if there were next time? What have you learned of this oil spill?
Well, I'm sure that's going to be a follow-on. There'll be a lot of things learned, I suppose, that, and I'm not prepared to really give you all the specifics on that because they might be some of my views, and they might not be endorsed, but they could go to, you know, to regulation of stiffer regulations on the traffic handling. There'll be stiffer regulations on the terminal. There could be stricter regulations on the... I don't know if there could be any stricter. There wasn't the fact that the regulations were loose with respect to the drinking. That was an established policy, but so was a 55-mile speed limit, you know. Okay, thank you.
Is that true? They're going to be hiring 500 more people in the next week?
By the end of next week, there'll be 500 more people.
Yeah. Is that true, Mr. Teal?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
500 more will bring it to 800.
Yeah. Locally?
Yeah.
Okay, but
you can ask Mr. Harrison if you like, but I mean, that's what he told me, and he told the people who are standing there in front of him.
I want to let Exxon speak for Exxon. I don't want to take it on you.
I'm sorry.
I'm just hoping to let Exxon speak for Exxon.
No, that's fine, but I mean, I was standing there, so it's not exactly hearsay. Okay. I heard him tell the other person and answer that same question. Thank you very much.
Rear Admiral Ed Nelson, who is commander of the 17th Coast Guard District, which is all of Alaska, concluding this press conference at the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom. Also, we heard Andrew Teal, who is a technical advisor to the Exxon response team and is with the Canadian Exxon affiliate. We also heard several responses, not a statement, but several of the responses were bucked from Admiral Nelson to Commander Steve McCall, who is the port captain for Valdez, who is the head of the Coast Guard detachment here at Port Valdez. Not a lot of new information. Admiral Nelson indicating that there wasn't a specific shopping list that he had in response to President Bush's indication that increased federal resources would be available to the oil spill. Mostly, at this point, flights and skimming equipment. And the use of Air Force transportation aircraft has been ongoing since the early stages of the spill response, and that will continue. We heard a fairly lengthy presentation by Andrew Teal talking about the prioritization of different sensitivities relating to various categories of environmental sensitivity, economic sensitivity, sensitivity becoming a noun that means some category of areas of concern, evidently. We also heard a description of a phased cleanup operation, and I think a good point made that as long as there is a large amount of oil in the water, beach cleanup may be, or large-scale beach cleanup may well be premature because of the problem with re-oiling. There have been some beach cleanup work done, much of it experimental, some of it attempting to get oil out of tide pools, again to prevent further contamination of beaches or re-oiling of beaches that have been cleaned. The Coast Guard feeling fairly confident about the working relationship between the various groups, Exxon and its subsidiaries and contractors, and the Coast Guard and their people. We heard both Admiral Nelson and Andrew Teal speaking warmly about the degree of cooperation and coordination and feeling confident that steps are being undertaken to meet the problem. No specific discussion about some of the questions raised this morning by Cordovans having to do with the inability to mobilize some of the resources that are available. This conference was again hosted by the Coast Guard. We heard Admiral Ed Nelson, Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District, Andrew Teal, an Exxon technical advisor from the Exxon Canadian affiliate, and Commander Steve McCall, port captain for the Port of Valdez. We have no word of any further public briefings or press conferences today Also, we have yet to receive indication of schedules for tomorrow. That will be Sunday, the 9th, although there was some brief comment about the possibility of some DEC briefing. If there is a large-scale press briefing or a public announcement by DEC or any other of the participants in the cleanup and its the spill and its aftermath, we will broadcast those. I want to take this moment to thank KCHU volunteer Tricia King for her assistance in this broadcast. Back at the KCHU studios is Laura Lee. Also, I'd like to announce that continuing coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and cleanup has been made possible in part by an emergency grant from the City of Valdez and by listener contributions. This broadcast is made possible through the combined efforts of KCHU Radio in Valdez, Alaska, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and Alaskom. I'm Dave Hammack, coming to you live from the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.